Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the world met once again on climate change, this time in Egypt. What exactly did they agree to do, and what did they fail to do? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The latest climate change meetings, COP27, just ended in Egypt. New meetings on biodiversity are taking place right now, and meetings on plastic waste just ended as well. So on today's show, we're going to explore, first of all, what wasn't advanced, what was accomplished, and what were missed opportunities at the COP27 meetings, as well as exploring these other areas on biodiversity and on plastic waste, particularly plastic waste in the ocean. Our guests today are Pamela Chasick. She's professor of political science at Manhattan College. She's the author of several books, including Global Environmental Politics, and is the editor of the Earth Negotiations Bulletin. You can find that at emb.iisd.org. And Shannon Gibson, associate professor of environmental studies at the University of Southern California. She's the author of the very recently published Throwing Soup on a Van Gogh and Other Ways Young Climate Activists Are Making Their Voices Heard Over Egypt's Climate Summit Protest Suppression. You can find that in The Conversation. And she participated virtually with students in the COP27 meetings through the Global Justice Ecology Project. Thank you both very much for joining us. Shannon, I'll start with you. The COP27 came with some expectations, possibly building on what seemed to be at least some minor successes at Glasgow. Did it accomplish what activists had hoped that it would?
You know, I think this one, as we've come to see with most of the COPs of late, is a mixed bag, that we tend to get some small progress. It kind of feels like the COPs have really become, it's not so much, you know, take two steps forward, one step back. It just each one feels like we're taking like a 16th of a step forward sometimes. So unfortunately, it felt like a lot of the beginning of the first 2 weeks was actually renegotiating and reestablishing some of the commitments made during COP26 at Glasgow. You know, so debates about tipping points and targets, some reversal on common but differentiated responsibilities. So it did seem as though we certainly, from an activist and a climate justice perspective, did not achieve all the wins that we were hoping to. You know, the big headline, of course, is loss and damages. And so, yes, it is helpful that they have sort of in COP tradition set up, that basically made a decision to start a process to get something done. So we, you know, there's the basically a framework set up to establish the loss and damages fund for next year. But again, a lot of those details are still need to be sorted out. And we always know the devil's in the details. And so digging into what that looks like in terms of implementation is really going to be crucial moving forward.
And Pam Chasick, it looked like the meeting was going to end with almost no agreement at all. I know they held it open for an extra day or so to try to get some sort of an agreement. Was that trying to salvage some sort of victory after what really looked like it was a pretty unproductive meeting?
No, because that's how COPs go. There's been a tradition, sadly, for at least over a decade, that delegates tend to use all available space and time. And when they run out of time, they just stop the clock and keep going. And I've got to say that in 30 years of negotiations, I saw this at my very first negotiation in 1992. So this is the norm. And, you know, that various participants start a betting pool halfway through the second week of climate COPs in terms of how many hours it will go over. So sadly, it's become the norm, not the exception. And yes, they're always trying to pull out a deal on something, trying to reach agreement on some of the decisions they have to make. But unfortunately, it was expected. You know, it didn't matter what the topic was.
This loss and damage that came out of this, I want to kind of delve into this. But first off, it really struck me. Pam, I'll ask you first, and then Shannon, you can respond as well, that it was pretty adamant this was not seen as environmental justice or, you know, part of this tendency to view this as responses to colonialism or underdevelopment, but instead very much based on the principle of polluter pays. I guess First of all, why was that so important that this be framed around the wealthy countries need to pay this because you're the one doing the pollution, as opposed to a justice question where some of the most impoverished people in the world are the ones who are suffering the most damage as a result of climate change?
I think people were viewing it both ways, and I'm sure Shannon can add more to that on the justice side. With regard to the polluter pays, this has been the basis behind the UN framework on climate convention on climate change since the beginning, was that the developed countries are those who are required to take action, not the developing countries. This was also framed in the Kyoto Protocol that was adopted in 1997, that only developed countries were required to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. So going back to that notion of common but differentiated responsibilities that is enshrined in the UNFCCC, that this is the responsibility of developed countries. You've done the pollution, you've got to deal with the mitigation. And now going one step further, you should have to pay for the impacts that you have had. This is something that small island developing states in particular have been calling for almost since the beginning. And they made a little bit of progress by creating a work program on loss and damage a number of years ago in Warsaw, and have been pushing that, you know, there's a need for more funding, particularly adaptation funding. Where should that money come from? Well, it should come from those who are the polluters, the developed countries. I have a lot more to say about funding issues, but why don't we give Shannon a chance and we can come back to that.
I definitely want to come back to who's doing the funding, how is it going to be funded, et cetera. And I can
tell you why it's not going to work.
But first, Shannon, I know you do a great deal of work on environmental justice questions. Is this an environmental justice issue? Should this be an environmental justice issue? Or should it really be focused much more on you did the polluting, you should have to clean it up?
I absolutely think it's an environmental and climate justice question, right? Whenever we get into these discussions of dealing with global climate change, we have to acknowledge historic responsibility that the quote unquote developed countries have in causing this problem. And so one of the big letdowns and disappointments from a climate justice perspective is that developed countries outright blocked the notion of liability in the language, right? Because they don't want to be held responsible for, you know, in perpetuity for funding loss and damage. But beyond just the sheer fact of the wording around it, there's also several huge holes and things to be looked at in the financing side. So first, we don't really have a clear target of how much money should be raised. And again, if you're familiar with the COPs, you know that most funding promises go unfulfilled, right? So we've been hearing about this $100 billion annually on climate change, mostly for mitigation. That was a promise made back in 2009. So there's a lot of concern that this is, you know, just another kind of big announcement to be made so that the developed countries can get on the stage and say, look how great we're doing. And then 10 years down the road, we'll see that, like the Green Climate Fund, it's underfunded. And I'm sure Pam and I, we can get into also, there's the issue of whether this is private or public funding. Do emerging economies contribute, such as China? How do you get access to the money? Again, all of these little details are so important to whether or not this is going to work in the future.
I do find it interesting you call how do you access the money a little detail. That seems to be a pretty big one. That was my initial response. And Shannon, I'll ask this as a follow-up, that there's been this promise for $100 billion in this Green Climate Fund. And actually, that was interesting. A lot of people think that was 2015, you know, as part of the Paris Agreement, but that was actually agreed to before Paris, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And so you create a new fund and promise to fund it, but you haven't funded the previous ones. And I saw a number of commenters saying, we don't need new agreements and new funds. We need to fulfill what we've already promised before going forward. Would that have been a more fruitful approach, or it's not going to grab headlines?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things, is it doesn't grab headlines. And it seems like COPs have been, they've become that at this point, that they're all about you know, big proclamations, big announcements, and trying to steal, you know, like a week of headlines on the so-called good doings on behalf of the developed countries. But yeah, I agree. You know, what they should have done is looked at what were the problems with the Green Climate Fund. And we already know what they were. Not only was it underfunded, but there's massive barriers to accessing those funds. So when you look both at the, you know, the GEF, the Global Environment Facility, and the Green Climate Fund, the majority of funding ends up going to China, India, Brazil, you know, are sort of emerging economies, and the most vulnerable, the countries that need it the most, are low-lying island nations. Other vulnerable countries simply don't have the capacity to be able to write these extensive applications to then put into effect the programs that they want to. And so I agree, you know, before we just create another fund and slap a new name on it, let's figure out what worked and what didn't work in the previous iterations.
Pam, one of the issues with respect to loss and damage is we understand the types of issues. My understanding is, for instance, the Pakistani representative's presentation about the floods, you know, in Pakistan immediately comes to mind. But how are they going to quantify the level of loss and damage? And especially when you consider, for some of these issues, we know climate change is a contributing factor, but it's tricky to say climate change causes a hurricane. We know that they cause more intense hurricanes. We know that there's more damage because of it. But how do you quantify the loss and damage?
Well, as Shannon said, and before, that they agreed to start a process towards the creation of fund. These are some of the issues they have to discuss. What's going to qualify for funding? What, you know, a lot of the countries that are have been calling for a loss and damage fund are looking at, so how do we, one, rebuild after devastating floods or storms or other, you know, sea level rise, things like that? How do we relocate people? Who's going to pay for all of those things that are related to climate change? But in terms of those details, that's something they have to work out. They have to define what will qualify, what won't, but it could all be a moot process if there's no funding.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Pam Chasick of Manhattan College and Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California. So Shannon, with a focus on loss and damage, but the underfunding and the clear bottlenecks and barriers with the Green Climate Fund. The Green Climate Fund, my understanding, was meant to be much more focused on mitigation, trying to stop temperatures from rising, trying to stop climate change. Where loss and damage is much more about adaptation. How do you actually deal with the damage? Are these meetings shifting, and is the conversation shifting away from mitigation and more towards adaptation? Are we kind of throwing our hands up saying, this is going to happen, we might as well deal with the consequences?
Yeah. And so actually there's sort of three funding points, because loss and damages is considered separate from adaptation. So we have mitigation, which focuses on how, as you were saying, to kind of keep us from increasing average global temperatures. Adaptation are the things that we do to deal with the currently changing climate. And there's a whole range of things. So that could be things like, you know, relocating populations because of rising sea levels. It could be using genetically engineered seeds so that we can continue to grow food in droughts in higher temperature areas. And then loss and damage is more about compensation for damage coming mostly from natural disasters is kind of the framing around it. And so we do have different pots of money for those things. But I would agree that in the last 10 years, particularly, you know, and this was the other thing, was right before COP27, which again happens each year, there was kind of this onslaught of new reports that came out from the IPCC, the World Environmental Meteorological Organization, looking at all these different massive, like the emissions gap report. And I think that as that scientific consensus continues to become more and more dire, there is an acknowledgement that we may have missed the boat a bit on mitigation. It's not too late, right, to minimize suffering and to continue to act on it. But certainly from a developing country perspective and a justice perspective, there has been a rhetorical shift to focusing on adaptation and loss and damage in more recent years.
And Pam, yeah, go ahead. You were going to respond to that.
Yeah, let me just add one other thing is that for many years, the focus was on mitigation, and you found a number of countries saying, well, we also need to address adaptation. We can't just be a mitigation focused convention. That was one of the issues with the Kyoto Protocol as well. It was focused almost 100% on mitigation. And so we need to address both. I don't think we have lost focus on mitigation. The IPCC reports have, you know, basically said that there is some more time. We still can't, nobody's willing to say we're going to miss the 1.5 target, but we can definitely try to avoid the 2.0, target. The focus on loss and damage, on adaptation, which has been called for by a lot of the developing countries, is because, you know, with the Green Climate Fund and other things, that too much funding has gone into mitigation, they fear, and not enough into addressing adaptation and addressing loss and no funding for loss and damage yet. So that I think it is more of a, you know, you have to take a more holistic point of view here. And for the developing countries, you know, we don't need to mitigate. We haven't caused this problem. However, we are suffering from this problem, and you all need to help us adapt, and you all need to pay us for the loss and damage suffered from climate change. So I think, you know, you've got, that's becoming the focus of a lot of developing countries, while they're still putting pressure on developed countries, you know, to mitigate.
Now, despite the fact that the IPCC seemed to be fairly clear that we're going to miss the 1.5 centigrade mark, and now it's really about making sure it doesn't go 2 degrees Celsius above the, you know, pre-industrial average temperatures, the actors themselves made a statement that they're still committed to 1.5, correct? Is that just for press, or are they really denying, are they really trying to challenge the IPCC saying, you know, you're being too pessimistic, we think we can actually hit this? Pam, I'll direct that at you first, since you addressed the, you know, that question.
I think it's largely nobody likes to use the word fail in the United Nations. You did not achieve. You did not fail. You know, it's all words. And the word failure is not acceptable. So to admit failure at this point also is not acceptable. But also, I think that if you admit failure at this point, you're still giving a license to pollute. You know, okay, we're not going to meet 1.5. So you can keep, you know, consuming fossil fuels, and you don't need to worry about curbs on methane emissions or anything else, because we've already missed that target. So you can keep going till we miss the next one. So I don't think anybody wants to shape the conversation that way. So you need to shape the conversation of how, you know, that we still, you know, let's do whatever we can while we still can. That's just my interpretation.
But Shannon, if that's true, one thing that seemed to be lacking is a firm statement saying we need the transition away from fossil fuels, correct? There was this pushback from oil producing nations that said, we don't want any statement saying we have to give up fossil fuels. And to me, if you're not prepared to make that statement, you're not really all that committed to mitigation, are you?
Yeah. And we saw kind of a repeat of last year, you know, this whole debate about, can we get a phase out of coal or a phase down? And what do we mean by, you know, unabated subsidies, and kind of this language that was talked a lot about at COP26 in Glasgow. And it was a repeat this year of that, of trying to get that same language in. And it was interesting, my students that we were following the talks with, and, you know, waking up very early in the morning to get the new language and to compare them over time. And one of my students joked that, you know, maybe you should take last year's Glasgow Pact and this year's agreement, the implementation plan, and put them into your plagiarism checker that you use as a professor, because we don't think it would pass muster in terms of originality. And so, yeah, you know, we definitely see, again, not a lot of progress in some of this language. And then also, not only was it the developed countries, but you have to also acknowledge the fact that if you took all the individual representatives that attended either a U.S. state delegations or observers that have connections to fossil fuel, the fossil fuel industry, and totaled them up, they were technically the biggest delegation, right? So you also have a lot of lobbying coming in through business and industry, as well as through states that did have quite an impact, it seems, on the final outcome.
This just seems to be such a historic opportunity. I mean, yesterday, Russian oil was officially taken off the market to the EU. We've been thinking a lot about oil consumption because of Russia's war in Ukraine. And there's a general agreement, certainly across Europe, that if we've learned anything about Russia's aggression, is that we should transition away from fossil fuels and start heavily investing in more renewable energy. So this seems to be a really missed opportunity. If even at our environmental meetings, we can't make a distinct statement that we need to phase out fossil fuels and move towards renewable energies. I suspect you both would agree with that statement, but how big of a missed opportunity is that? Or is it just, this has kind of become standard that, you know, this is just not an issue that the parties to the IFCCC want to take on? Pam, I'll ask you that first.
Do I have permission to go into a procedural corner for a moment?
Sure, absolutely.
So herein lies the problem, as you know, back at COP1, and sadly I can say I was at COP1, and that when they were discussing the rules of procedure for the COP, when they got to the voting rules, and the European, it wasn't even, you know, the European Union, brand new European Union, by the way, asked for permission to vote on behalf of its members. And a number of countries, particularly the Saudis, who all the way back at COP1 had advisors from the oil industry there. And I can tell you exactly who it was, but he's passed away, so I will give him the benefit of the doubt, that arguing that you don't want voting rules in this COP because you will be overruled. You've got to keep it so everything has to be agreed by consensus. So basically, they objected to the European Union being able to vote on behalf of all of its members. Part of the problem was, do you have the number of votes for every EU member? And what if they're not present? Do you still get to vote for them? But that's just window dressing, because if you have to make every decision by consensus, it means that if one country objects to phasing out coal or phasing out oil, then it doesn't pass. So climate change and other processes have followed suit, and we're stuck in this thing with most of these post-Rio conventions don't have voting rules because some countries don't want to be overruled in a vote. And this, I'm going to call out the Saudis and a number of oil producers and coal producers at the top of that list. And so using the EU issue as, you know, something to hide behind. But when the real issue is, had we had voting, we would have seen a phase out of coal.
Go ahead, Shannon.
I was, if I could chime in, just to give Pam some kudos here. When I got back to ask my whole class if they could summarize COP27, I gave them like little pieces of paper to kind of write down their thoughts. And the number one answer, because they read your textbook, was lowest common denominator, which is a byproduct of the procedural rules of how the COPs run, particularly consensus-based decision-making. So, you know, I think that's very good to point out that we don't have, you know, the typical voting that we see in some other political forums, that this need for consensus really does water down a lot of the agreements. And that is correct, that then the UN is kind of in charge with putting a bow on repetitively weak agreements time after time, especially since the failures around COP15 in 2009.
That's three political scientists on this, yeah, you know, in this meeting all saying procedure matters. And they have these seemingly boring questions really are ways to look at bigger, you know, broader questions. So Pam, since, you know, Shannon, you know, gave you the kudos, and I think this is a great opportunity, is this yet another example of just a lowest common denominator? And so the lesson here is that whatever movement, despite the fact that we're facing this climate crisis, the movement's going to typically be pretty small steps because the nature of this consensus.
Within the UNFCCC process, yes. However, we have to also remember that we have a treaty, but we don't have to put all of our eggs in the basket of that treaty. You know, national governments have a role to play above and beyond the treaty, should they wish to do so. Local governments, state governments, all have roles to play with regard to contributing to both the mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions as well as adaptation. There are all sorts of examples of best practices on both sides that are being shared in numerous other fora. We also have to remember, and this is also a big issue there, is the role the private sector has to play. And the private sector is not governed by the UNFCCC. Private sector is governed by national governments. And so national governments can take the responsibility to put greater curbs on greenhouse gas emissions from industry, and also to create opportunities for private sector funding for mitigation, for adaptation, and for loss and damage. And we can't just say, just because the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change is not making any progress and maybe even backtracking from previous COPs, doesn't mean that we have to throw up our hands and say all is, you know, there's nothing else we can do.
When we come back, what is the global environmental agenda, including biodiversity and the scourge of plastics? Stay with us.
And welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the global environmental agenda with a particular emphasis on the COP27 meetings, the climate change meetings that just ended in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, a few weeks ago, as well as other environmental issues on biodiversity, on plastic pollution, et cetera. What exactly was accomplished, and particularly now, what should be the agenda going into the future? Our guests today are Pam Chasek from Manhattan College and Shannon Gibson from the University of Southern California. So Shannon, COP28 is going to happen next year. First of all, where is it taking place? And at this point, what are you hoping is on the agenda that has not been on the agenda?
Yeah, so, and Pam, you might have to double check me here. Next year is in the United Arab Emirates. In terms of a city, I'm not sure quite yet. But, you know, for those of us who research these issues and attend the COPs, either virtually or in person, I can tell you that, you know, from a civil society perspective, talking to people who were on the ground in Egypt, there were a lot of concerns about the openness, the democratic processes, the space for civil society to be able to engage, and having it in the UAE next year brings that same set of concerns. So if you want to talk about, you know, openness for non-state actors and NGOs, and not to mention fossil fuel interests, it's not going to be the most hospitable geopolitical context, probably. Again, from a, you know, in terms of what we want to see for COP28, I think this time this was dubbed the implementation COP. I think COP28 is going to be, you know, the implementation COP, the sequel, that we still just have so much to work out in terms of how, you know, again, loss and damage, carbon trading rules, so many things that seemingly keep getting punted. And then one final thing I think that we will continue to see, hopefully, you know, as one of the brighter spots, will be increased engagement from the youth constituency. The UNFCCC has made more efforts to acknowledge youth participation and to set up a unique platform for them. So that's something I'm looking forward to hopefully seeing grow.
Yeah, before we drill down on that, though, I do, Shannon, want to ask you, since you had mentioned about youth, and then we'll come back to this. You've written this piece about the, I guess we'll call them the soup protests, the, you know, the number of protests that seem to be driven by youth. Could you synopsize the argument and why is it that we've seen this type of protest, you know, surrounding these meetings?
I think at this point, the younger generations are saying, look, you all had decades before we were born to start working on this. Now we've watched you do it for 2-3 decades your way, and it's not working. And so we're going to be loud. We're going to take to the streets. We're going to engage in civil disobedience in order to raise this issue to the top of the agenda. It is hard still to keep climate change in the news cycle with everything going on in the world. And what these youth activists are saying is that this is literally our lives at stake, right? And so, yes, they will risk getting arrested, being deported, being fined to make that statement. And what they're doing isn't anything new either, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're drawing on a long historical tradition of civil disobedience from the civil rights movement and other uprisings. So, you know, I think that what has been done, while it can draw quite a bit of outrage from people, I think in this case is being creative, is being unique, and is they're literally fighting for their lives in this case.
Mm. And it seems to me, we just finished a midterm election process here in the United States, obviously, and they were saying the top issues, certainly reproductive rights, access to abortion, more on that list, inflation, crime, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But there's been very few news outlets that have linked the very substantial rise in the number of voters in the age range between 18 and 29. And when they're asked what is the most important issue, they frequently will say climate change, or mm-hmm. abortion and climate change were the two top issues. And that almost never gets reported. So I guess throwing, you know, soup on a, by the way, protected piece of art. I mean, it wasn't like they were destroying the piece of art. Yeah.
The accusations of vandalism, you know, I'm not a criminal lawyer, but there deserves some inspection there. And I think the other thing, like all of us, right, as faculty that deal with students on a daily basis, the other thing is the connection between climate change and the mental health crisis we're seeing right now. Mm-hmm. I've heard and seeing reports now on eco-depression, eco-anxiety, that, you know, as much as students are and this generation are concerned about, you know, getting a job and making a living and buying a house, those are wrapped up in concerns about the ecological future as well.
So, Pam, what do you expect are going to be the agenda for COP28? And which city was that in? I saw you.
It's probably in Dubai.
Yeah, probably in Dubai. Probably. Okay.
So the big thing that has to happen at the next COP is the global stock take. And this was something that was called for under the Paris Agreement, where the formal sort of declaration are, where are we since, you know, countries have these nationally determined contributions that they make under the Paris Agreement. We know that they're not enough, but this will be the formal sort of declaration that what countries have committed to doing and what countries have also actually done, we're not there. So the Sharm el-Sheikh meeting was basically even Glasgow, but kicking off this process leading to the 2023 global stocktake, which is then supposed to take place every 5 years. So my sense is, depending on how all of this goes, that the word, you know, if I'm going to jump ahead a year, and I'm happy, mm-hmm. I'm hopeful to eat my words a year from now, but that the words coming out of COP28 is that nationally determined contributions are not enough. Mm-hmm. And what can we do to spur action? It's also possible that governments will up their NDCs. That's what's hoped for between now and COP28. If you remember, at COP26 in Glasgow, they were hoping that governments would up their commitments COVID threw all of this into a loop. And a lot of people have been using COVID as an excuse why certain things have not been done. And so it's going to be really interesting over the next 11 months to see, are we going to get a spate of increased, you know, more ambitious NDCs? Are we going to see others outside of governments make their own NDCs? Like New York City, for example, has one. Other cities have their own, what they're planning on doing. So universities, you know, all sorts of advice. What are they also, can we, you know, get them to announce, you know, what they're planning on doing? Are they going to increase their reductions? So I think, you know, that's, you know, in addition to all of the things that were not really done at COP27 or COP26 that are still on the agenda. But there's also been talk that, you know, you've heard a lot, if I can go in this direction a bit, about, you know, the COPs aren't working. You know, do we need to do a total reform? Do we need to remove items from the agenda? Do we need to streamline this agenda? Do we need to rethink how we're talking about funding? And I just wanted to put in a plug for the Prime Minister from Barbados, Mia Motley, who has a proposal with regard to funding, particularly for loss and damage and other, to really call upon the IMF to allocate special drawing rights for climate change, and then being able to use that to leverage contributions from philanthropies and the private sector, and which is probably, you know, is really where I see this going. If we're going to continue to rely on governments alone, and are we going to continue to say that developed countries have to pay because, you know, they cause the problem, we're going to stay in this loop forever. And Prime Minister Motley has realized that and said that, you know, we can do one of two things. We could stand on our high horse and say, well, nothing's going to happen until the developed countries put up the money. Or can we change the international financial system to address climate change? And so, and really make progress on this. So we start to, we need to see some of these new ideas. It'll be, you know, how this takes on in other fora. So once again, going back to the point that we can't just look at the UNFCCC, then finally the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is going to have its delayed synthesis report release in, you know, early in 2023. And which is going to lead to another whole set of media attention on climate change that could also maybe put some additional pressure on governments and other international organizations as we head towards the next COP.
Getting into questions about private sector and philanthropy, I guess there's, you know, two related questions. And Shannon, you can choose which one of the two you want to take on here. The first would be, corporations expected to, first of all, become greener than their governments might necessarily require and possibly contribute, or just wealthy, you know, philanthropists being able to provide resources that, you know, I think of the model, at least, certainly some criticisms of Bill Gates, but the model being like the, you know, the Gates Foundation being focused and other factors there. If we don't have the political will at the elected level, at the electoral level, for developed countries to be able to contribute to loss and damage and green climate fund, et cetera, should we look beyond the, you know, governments and try to tap into some of these excessively wealthy individuals? I'm looking at you, Elon Musk. If you really are committed to, you know, I know you listen to the show. If you really are committed to this, how about stop buying Twitter and give money to the Green Fund? Anyway, Shannon, your thoughts on that?
So I think that in order to bridge the funding gap, we do need to look towards business and industry, as well as to foundations and other philanthropic funding, but to do so quite cautiously. And for sort of two reasons, right? With a lot of money can oftentimes come a lot of sway, and there's concern about conflict of interest. as well as greenwashing. And so in kind of two examples, because I also teach on global public health and have looked a lot at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and kind of some of the power that they've had at being one of the largest donors to the World Health Organization, you know, there have been some criticisms that because of their overwhelming financial influence, that they have largely been able to direct some of the WHO's agenda and policies in ways that maybe don't speak to what local groups want and need, that some of their choices have backfired by focusing on things like immunizations and quick medicines, as opposed to like really getting at the root causes of poor health. So I think we need to think about what about legitimacy, authority, power and input, right? And similarly, when you look at on the private sector side, I get concerned that if now oil and gas companies and coal companies can contribute to loss and damages, that's just another wave of greenwashing. Does that not then give them the license to continue to pollute, but then to advertise the good work that they're doing? So I think, yes, we need other actors beyond just governments to help bridge the gap in funding. But there need to be some sort of checks and balances to make sure that those groups then don't have more influence than impacted and vulnerable communities.
Pam, same question.
No, I totally agree with what Shannon just had to say. And I think there, and that's why, you know, one of the sort of interesting things about Prime Minister Motley's proposal is that you're dealing, you know, you're trying to leverage more money out of the international financial institutions, not just solely relying on the private sector to make up the difference, because there's a lot of people who don't even want the private sector to be at climate meetings, much less fund for the reasons that Shannon stated.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing climate change, the COP27 meetings, and other environmental issues, the global environmental agenda, with Pam Chasick of Manhattan College and Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California. And speaking of those other agendas, right now, a treaty that doesn't get nearly as much attention as the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or what we call the UNFCCC. But those meetings are taking place right now, and you know, concerns about endangered, critically endangered, potential, you know, threatened species all across the planet have just risen. Now, it's linked obviously to climate change. Climate change is one of the causes of this. But Pam Chasick, what are they talking about at the biodiversity meetings? What's really on their agenda?
So the Convention on Biological Diversity was adopted actually in Rio at the same time as the Climate Change Convention. But you're correct, it's always received somewhat less attention. And part of the problem is with a lot of these, with that convention to combat desertification, it took a long time for them to come up with sort of measurable indicators. When you can't measure species loss, for example, it's very hard to get attention to that. And they tried this earlier with what are known as the Aichi biodiversity targets that expired in 2020 and which were not met. Very few of these targets were met. So the question they decided early on was, what's going to be our post-2020 biodiversity targets? Now, technically, these new targets were supposed to be adopted at, this is COP15 for the Biodiversity Convention, was supposed to take place actually in China in 2020. But COVID prevented that from happening and postponed all of these negotiations for really two full years. Negotiations took place sporadically, just like with the climate change treaty, a number of parties did not believe one could negotiate online. You could exchange information. You could keep momentum alive, but not have negotiations. So what is expected out of this COP is a new post-2020, it's still being called, global biodiversity framework that will set the agenda. Technically, it was supposed to be till 2030. I'm wondering if they may extend it should they reach agreement of what new targets there should be. And this fits under a larger agenda that UNEP, the UN Environment Program has set forth to address what they're calling the triple planetary crisis of climate change, biodiversity loss, and pollution. So they just finished 3 days of negotiations in this post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework Working Group that was set up. They set up an additional meeting to meet just prior to the COP. The COP has an opening ceremony today, on the 7th, on the 6th, and then formally gets underway on the 7th. Based on what's happened the last 3 days, they're as far apart as ever, and it's going to be quite the difficulties of pulling this new framework out of a hat. It hinges on some of the age-old issues in terms of access and benefit sharing, in terms of payments for developing countries, and perhaps the most interesting issue, which there may be progress on, is something called digital sequence information. And this is if pharmaceutical companies and other companies can get the genetic code for certain forms of biodiversity and thus are no longer have to give payments to developing countries where that biodiversity comes from in exchange for developing new pharmaceuticals and other products, that many feel that they're not going to have that financial incentive to help developing countries conserve their biodiversity.
So Shannon, it seems like some of the old stories here, that there's a commitment to preservation of species broadly, but devil's in the details, devil's in the funding. I always like to tell my students, remember, budgets are statements of values. What you spend your money on is what you value. So with that in mind, on the issue of biodiversity, what should be the focus in trying to, it seems like, jumpstart a post-COVID commitment to biodiversity?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to look at biodiversity and climate change and think about them in the context of environmental governance, because it's unique in this arena where we have these regimes that sometimes treat environmental issues in silos, but in reality, we know that they impact one another. So again, it's sort of like what Pam brought up before, like these procedural issues that can make things difficult. And we know historically, the United States has kind of been a big stumbling block in the Convention on Biodiversity in the CBD. And so there's, and here we have a different set of private interests, of big pharma, biotech, right? The private interests that want access to genetic resources for profit use. And so that kind of falls under the CBD. But then we also have, just like climate change, it's not all being dealt with, in a singular institution. We also have, there are so many other treaties that we have on biodiversity for migratory species, trade in endangered species. It is this really complex web of different treaties that exist around similar issues. And so I think one thing looking forward is, and then you also have, like, again, the Aichi targets, the Sustainable Development Goals, which include two targets on biodiversity, one on land, one in water, is really how you get convergence, right? When you have so much being done and discussed in different forums around biodiversity, how do you get some synthesis among them? Because I do think we have some gaps and some holes that are occurring because not everyone is talking across these different regimes or governance structures.
Yeah. And by the way, you were generous calling the U.S. a stumbling block for for biodiversity. They're not a party to the treaty.
That's correct.
And so maybe first and foremost, what we need for the Convention on Biological Diversity is for the U.S. to become a party. I bet. And Pam is shaking her head. That's not going to happen anytime soon, I imagine. Go ahead, Pam.
No, it's not. But with regard to what's really on the treaty level, all of the various biodiversity related treaties are all on board right now to rethink their strategic plans in line with these new global biodiversity targets should they be adopted. And there's a liaison group of all of these, of the biodiversity conventions, of which they meet on a regular basis. And they are all set to coordinate with regard to these new targets. The big stumbling block is the governments have to agree to them first.
We got time for one more sort of brief interjection on a topic. And Pamela, I'll go to you on this, and that's the plastics treaty. I can tell you, I teach a course on environmental studies, kind of a general education course on this. And the one thing that students come in knowing and want to do something about is the huge growing plastic. We used to call them islands, but they're almost like land masses now, or the huge, you know, garbage piles in the oceans, most notably the North Pacific, but in every ocean. It seems this may be a no-brainer. Why don't we phase out plastics? That's kind of on the table, but it seems like that initial drive to let's sign a treaty just to get rid of plastics, especially single-use plastics, seems to have hit some snags, right?
Well, negotiations have just begun. And back in end of February, beginning of March, the UN Environment Assembly finally, after years of discussions, agreed to set up an international or an intergovernmental negotiating committee on plastics, on plastic pollution, particularly in the marine environment. And so these negotiations had an organizational session. They had their first substantive session last week in Punta del Este, Uruguay. So I wouldn't, you know, the snags are what we expect at this point. Voting rules, the exact same issue. Because once again, where do plastics come from? Petrochemicals. Who are the main providers? You know, the Saudis and others. So the exact same issue that is affecting the climate change regime is affecting not the eventual treaty yet, but even the intergovernmental committee, saying we're not going to approve the voting rules, which means it's going to have to be adopted by consensus unless something changes. You know, so that's one thing. Another issue that's affecting the plastics, and this is also procedural before we even get into the substance, is the bureau, the people who are going to be guiding the process. And this we've seen in a number of cases as well, is that the Eastern European regional group cannot agree on a single candidate. And I've seen this in several other processes where both Ukraine and Russia have been nominated and they can't reach agreement. So that's another issue that's plaguing the beginnings of that process, is even electing a bureau to run it. They did elect a chair, however. But where you're going to get into trouble here is if you're looking down, you know, sort of what happened this past week, is that you're going to have to build this similar to the Minamata Convention on Mercury and other things of how are we going, and Montreal Protocol, I'm going to use as an example, because how are we going to find, we need to find replacements. Think of all the medical equipment that is plastic. What are we going to replace that with? What about recycling technology? It really doesn't work. How are we going to bring on board real recycling technology? And how are we going to recycle it with all of the chemical additives in a way that is safe and not going to provide additional harm to human health and the environment? How are, you know, getting rid of certain single-use plastics may appear to be pretty easy, but how are they going to be phased out? At what rate? What's going to be the replacement? What's going to be the cost? And one of the things that I think about a lot, water bottles, you know, plastic water bottles are a scourge on our existence. But in a lot of countries where you can't drink the tap water because it's not good, how are you going, you know, what are you going to use for these very easily purchased, easily disposable plastic water bottles? So it's a more complicated issue, like any environmental issue. And one of the last little things to say about this is the question of who's going to be able to participate. What's going to be the role of stakeholders, both industry, as well as non-governmental organizations, civil society, and organizations of waste pickers, people who make their living by going through waste dumps and other waste and taking out recyclable materials. So who also want to have a presence there. And so, you know, that's another thing going forward, which is very similar to what we talked about with climate. And they made the argument that having a multi-stakeholder forum the day before the negotiations, like they did in Uruguay, is all fine and good. But no, we don't want a separate forum. We want to be able to speak during the negotiations. But then again, what about, you know, the petrochemical industries and the plastic manufacturers? You know, do we want them at the table? Are they going, or are they going to be a stumbling block? But others are saying, well, they're part of the problem and have to be part of the solution. So these are some of the issues that they need to address as they move forward. The next meeting will be in May.
And actually, with that, we'll go ahead and end this conversation with a very important note that this is just the beginning of, on the plastics, just the beginning of those conversations, the importance of focusing on biodiversity. I would add as well on desertification. You know, quite a bit of the literature suggests exactly what Shannon suggested, that they have tended to be siloed in a way that we really need to view this as much more of kind of a coherent whole. These things are very much intertwined. But the justification of spending most of the conversation on climate change is, I think we would all agree, that on all of these other issues, if we address climate change, we will make very positive impacts on preserving biodiversity, on combating desertification, and all of these other issues. So I guess if there's a message here, climate change is still out there. We're paying attention, and we very badly, you know, need to have greater progress. We've been talking about the global environmental agenda, particular emphasis on climate change, but also biodiversity, plastics, other issues, and a bit of a postmortem, if you will, on COP27 and looking forward to the COP28 meetings next year. Our guests today have been Pamela Chasing. She is professor of political science at Manhattan College. She's the author of several books, including The Wonderful Global Environmental Politics, and also the editor of the Earth Negotiations Bulletin. You can find that at emb.iisd.org. And Shannon Gibson, associate professor of environmental studies at the University of Southern California. She is the author of the very recently posted Throwing Soup on a Van Gogh and Other Ways Young Climate Activists Are Making Their Voices Heard Over Egypt's Climate Summit Protest Suppression. You can find that in The Conversation. And she participated virtually with students at the COP26, COP27 meetings, I suspect COP28 as well, through the Global Justice Ecology Project. Thank you both very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian. Thank you.